This is the third installment of The Stories of Forgotten Women. This installment will describe the plight for women for suffrage and to be involved in the government. Enjoy Helen Taylor, a woman after her own mother. Every great woman has a great mother. Harriet Taylor, the mother of Helen Taylor, was a woman with ideas, and she was bound and determined to share them, no matter how radical they were. Part of the Unitarian Church, she befriended a philosopher by the name of John Stuart Mill, the first man who treated her as an equal. Harriet Taylor was already married and pregnant with Helen, who would be born a year later in 1831. Despite being married, Harriet saw something in John that was not present in her husband, a sense that women were people with their own minds and wills. The two wrote academic essays to each other about marriage and women's rights, and it became clear that Harriet Taylor expressed more radical views about these subjects. Of course, it should not be a surprise. Harriet Taylor was the woman, and women can have a lot more to say about their predicament due to experiencing womanhood firsthand. In an essay of hers, she argued, "Public offices being held open to them alike, all occupants would be divided between the sexes in their natural arrangements. Fathers would provide for their daughters in the same manner as their sons." To explain, women should be given opportunities and accommodated to fit their natural needs, such as menstruation, pregnancy, and motherhood. Also, a father should not give special treatment to their sons and leave their daughters with no fatherly attention. Not only was Harriet revolutionizing how people saw gender-based oppression, something that people were denying, but she was an avid reader of Robert Owens, a socialist. She read The Formation of Character and A New View of Society. These books promoted socialist philosophy. Why was Harriet Taylor interested in socialism? Socialism was and still is a very controversial idea, with people pointing out several key problems with it. She was intrigued by the idea because, as a woman, she and her fellow kin were economically dependent on men. Socialism emphasizes that all individuals, with an emphasis on all, work for the betterment of society and get equal outcome. Of course, this brings up the question of what happens to people who cannot work and need help to provide for their community, but that is a whole different discussion. According to Harriet, in order to fix the economically inequitable situation, all marriage laws should be radically reformed in favor for women. For example, women can have control over their own money without their husband's oversight. Since marriage laws come from the government, this would mean that the government had to be convinced enough that the laws have room for reform and improvement. Sadly, tragedy struck when Harriet Taylor and her now husband John Stuart Mill were writing the book The Subjection of Women. Even greatness has an end, for ambitious Harriet Taylor died of tuberculosis in 1858. Every great mother has a great daughter. Helen Taylor was born in 1831 and had the dream of becoming an actress in theater. After the death of her dear mother, she gave up theater and cared for her stepfather and helped him finish The Subjection of Women in 1869. The passionate fire for justice was already kindling. Helen had already given her heart to the women's suffrage movement, and she was an original member of the Kensington Society, the organization that produced the first petition requesting the vote for women. 2 years prior to the publication of The Subjection of Women, January of 1867, Helen made the plunge into written activism. Anonymously, she published the article, The Lady's Petition, in the Westminster Review. The article later became a pamphlet called The Claims of English Women to the Suffrage Constitutionally Considered. Later that summer, Helen Taylor and other suffrage activists joined to establish the London Society for Women's Suffrage. The idea behind this building was, is the extension of the parliamentary suffrage to women desirable, and if so, under what conditions? Due to women not being able to vote for people in Parliament, a large gap of underrepresentation existed. Only men were elected into Parliament by men, but that was about to change. On March 26, 1870, Helen gave her maiden speech to the suffrage cause in the Hanover Rooms. Her former passion of becoming an actress came in handy to overcome her initial stage fright, and her talent was noted. Miss Helen Taylor made a most remarkable speech. She is a slight young woman with long, thin, delicate features, clear dark eyes, and dark hair, which she wears in long bands on her cheeks. Fashionably dressed in slight mourning, speaks off the platform in a high, thin voice, very shyly embarrassed air. On the platform, she was very eloquent. A long and studied speech, it was good, but too much like acting. Like the woman who came before her, Helen Taylor made more waves with each passing day. She got herself involved in local politics, and after the 1870 Act of Education was passed, she became a candidate for office. She was elected to the Southwark seat on the London School Board in 1876, later joining the Social Democratic Federation in 1881. 4 years later, she spoke on the same platform as Richard Pankhurst as allies. His daughter, Sylvia Pankhurst, commented that her mother was shocked and disturbed that Helen Taylor wore trousers, and that she feared this wily woman would hurt Richard's election chances. They didn't. Despite the odds being against Helen for simply existing as a woman, she persisted with the memory of her mother in her heart. When she died in 1907, she died doing what she loved, caring for women. Unfortunately, for the longest time, women and government were claimed to be incompatible with each other. While men crowded to witness campaign speeches and then into the voting booths, women stayed at home and read the news about the political world. This order began to change in the 18th century with the American War for Independence and the French Revolution, when women made the connection between democracy and their liberties, which was little to none. One can recall the painting Liberarde, with a French woman standing amongst the charged scene with a French flag. The viewer can almost hear her rallying cry. Both events brought the rights of women forth. If men can call for proper representation and voting rights, then why can't women? Why should women, who are the majority of the world's population, not have the right to vote and run for government office? It took until this year to finally have a woman vice president. This injustice had a poor justification, which can still be heard in misogynist circles. This justification for the non-existence of women's legal status was that women were morally superior and more emotional, and therefore was a man's obligation to shield these oh-so-fragile creatures away from the political pollution in the world. Contrary to this belief, women are not dainty and fragile creatures who are beyond understanding. Women have been persecuted and shut away throughout history, and during the 18th and 19th centuries, this bitterness of being placed on a pedestal without their consent began to reveal itself. The subjection of women argues that the legal subordination of one sex to the other is wrong in itself, and now one of chief hindrances to human improvements. The mindset that women are morally superior may seem like a compliment at first glance. When you dig deeper into the statement, it is rife with toxic masculinity, rape culture, and a misrepresentation of women. The statement, "Women are morally superior to men," can act like an excuse for a man's improper behavior. If men are indoctrinated with the belief that they are innately morally inferior, then that instills that they can get away with improper behavior and not have to improve their moral compass because what is the point? This plays right into the statement, boys will be boys and men will be men. Young girls are expected to mature quicker than their boy peers because of the belief that women have a higher morality. Therefore, they must never raise their voice, get bruises from running around, or get their shoes muddy. Women are expected to act almost like guardian angels to men, gatekeeping immorality and rewarding them for decent behavior. Meanwhile, young boys can do all sorts of blatant immaturity, and the response is almost always, boys will be boys. This is because it is expected that men cannot be taught the right way to be at a young age, the responsibility falling onto women to act as role models. With this sort of mindset, victim blaming a woman who is raped is a common occurrence. Why were you dressed like that? You really expected him to control himself? Aside from sexual misconduct, the world of politics is the place where men can let out their worst behaviors and not face consequences. Former President Donald Trump took advantage of this, and throughout the 2016 election, his presidency, and the 2020 election, he was on his worst behavior until someone who wasn't enabling him had to give him a teleprompter. From making fun of a disabled reporter to bragging about groping women, the man was like a bull in a china shop, and many men felt justified in how they behaved towards women or other people. If a president of the United States can act like that, then why can't I? Due to the political sphere being a gateway for corruption and scandal, it sent shockwaves when women like Helen Taylor began to pioneer their way into politics. Again, with the assumption that women were morally superior, men didn't want women to supposedly get corrupted. Or in better words, get called out for their behavior. Men knew that if women got into these positions of power, reforms would be made to things that directly affected women. Legislation about marriage, employment, pay, childcare, and reproductive health would all be put under revision, and that is one of the many reasons why women wanted to vote and be voted on. Like I said before, there is also a misunderstanding about women due to the statement that we are morally superior. It is extremely toxic to put women on these pedestals because then we can never mess up or else we will be scorned for life with no chance for redemption. If a woman is out of line, they are the most vile person on the planet. Jokes will be made about said woman's wrongdoing that will be put on political campaign merchandise. It shall be the laughingstock of the century. Yes, former President Bill Clinton was held accountable for his actions, but he has not become the butt of jokes like Monica Lewinsky. Vice President Kamala Harris has been blasted left and right into the moon and back because, surprise, she's human and not perfect. Putting women on a morality pedestal will hold them to a double standard, while men get slapped on the wrist in comparison. If that, of course. That is why Helen Taylor and her mother changed the game for women in politics. They helped pave the way for women to be properly represented in the public eye and show that we have autonomy and are not just suited to being shut up at home. That is why the women's suffrage movement is so important to history. Thank you for listening to this installment of The Stories of Forgotten Women. Citations include Spartacus Education, Helen Taylor, Spartacus Educational, London Society for Women's Suffrage, and British Library, The Subjection of Women by J.S. Mill.